bifurcation theory. Looked at some of the most important codimension 1 bifurcations, saddle node bifurcation and the hop bifurcation. These are both examples of what we call local bifurcations because we can recognize these bifurcation points by analyzing the stability of a steady state close to the steady state in the local region around the steady state. And these bifurcations are all, they're recognized by the eigenvalues of the Jacobian matrix that describes the behavior of the system close to a steady state. So for instance, at a saddle node bifurcation, one of the eigenvalues of the steady state goes to zero, a real eigenvalue goes to zero. That's the signature of a saddle node bifurcation. And at a hop bifurcation, you have a pair of complex conjugate eigenvalues where the real part of the eigenvalues is going to zero. Okay, so those are called local bifurcations. We recognize them in the vicinity of the steady state. And it's very easy to compute these bifurcations because the computer is very good at calculating the eigenvalues of the Jacobian matrix, and it can track those eigenvalues and see when you pass through one of these bifurcation points. So we're picking up where we left off in lecture 2, which was how to locate and follow a point of a hop bifurcation. So at the top of slide 19, we see that if we want to locate a hop bifurcation, we simply have to monitor the real part of an eigenvalue or pair of eigenvalues close to the steady state. And when that real part crosses zero, that's when we can be sure we have a hop bifurcation. And then we can follow hop bifurcations in two parameters by solving a set of equations simultaneously. The first n equations are the equations that determine that we're at a steady state solution of the differential equations, and the n plus first equation is that the real part of the eigenvalue be equal to zero. That's the signature of a hop bifurcation. So as usual, we have n plus 1 equations and n plus 2 unknowns, and that defines implicitly a relationship between the two parameters P1 and P2. And so we can track that relationship using the implicit function theorem, and we'll sketch out a locus of points in the two-parameter bifurcation plane where the hop bifurcations occur. Now, I also mentioned last time that that hop bifurcations have two different possible directions, a supercritical hop bifurcation and a subcritical hop bifurcation. And the stability of the bifurcating limit cycles depends upon the direction of the bifurcation. There's an algebraic equation that would allow us to determine the direction of bifurcation at a hop bifurcation point. It's a very complicated function. In slide 20, it's called this function beta 2. I don't even list the arguments. There's a very long list of arguments, and it involves not only first derivatives, but second and third derivatives of the nonlinear rate equations evaluated at the steady state. And hardly anybody ever uses this formula to compute the direction of a hop bifurcation. Instead, what most software programs do is to actually follow the periodic solutions that bifurcate from the steady state. And if you observe that the periodic solutions bifurcate in one direction where the steady state becomes unstable, then you know that the periodic solutions are stable solutions. And if they bifurcate in the other direction, on the side where the steady state is stable, then the limit cycles have to be unstable. So you can determine the stability of the limit cycle simply by observing the direction in which they bifurcate away from the steady state. But you should know a little bit about how software like Auto is able to follow the limit cycle solutions of periodic, the limit cycle solutions of nonlinear differential equations. Because in general, it's a little bit hard to compute a limit cycle because it's a nonlinear set of differential equations, and limit cycle solutions generally are pretty complicated. They're not usually described by simple oscillatory functions like sines and cosines. However, close to a Hopf bifurcation, Hopf's theorem assures us that these small amplitude bifurcating limit cycles can indeed be described pretty accurately by sines and cosines. So close to the bifurcation point, we know that the periodic solutions look like sine of 2 pi t over omega and cosine of 2 pi t over omega, some linear combination of those two periodic functions. And omega is the imaginary part of the eigenvalue that's crossing the imaginary axis. So Otto can use these functions as an initial guess for the periodic solutions and then find exactly what the periodic solutions are by solving what's called a periodic boundary value problem. And that's on slide 21. So a periodic solution has the property that after some time, capital T, you return exactly to where you started. So you can find to find a periodic solution, you need to find a function that satisfies the differential equations in time and begins at time t equals zero at a certain point. That's the initial condition. And after time capital T, it comes back to identically to the place where you started. Then you know you're on a periodic solution. Now, the way Otto does this is, first of all, to scale the time variable with respect to capital T, the period of the periodic solution. So Otto expresses the differential equations in terms of a dimensionless time variable tall. The problem with this is that from the outset, we don't know what the period of the periodic solution is. We don't know it exactly. We only know approximately it's 2 pi over omega. But approximately is good enough. As long as we have a good starting condition, then Otto should be able to find the precise values that satisfy the differential equations. Okay, so this is how Otto can get started. It knows where the bifurcation occurs, so it has the critical value of the parameter, and it goes to a value close to the Hopf bifurcation point, and it knows that the periodic solution looks like a linear combination of sines and cosines, and it knows approximately what the period is. And it plugs that in and does some calculations, and okay, it's not quite right, but now it can twiddle the amplitude and the period of the periodic solutions to satisfy the periodic boundary value problem. And that's how it gets started. And it finds that if it goes to the wrong side, it's not able to satisfy the condition. So then it tries the other side of the bifurcation, and on one side or the other, it's able to satisfy the periodic boundary value problem. And then, once it has that periodic solution, it can follow that periodic solution in one parameter, because now it's able to get started, because it has a good guess to get started, and now it just has to inch along, changing the parameter a little bit at a time, always has a good starting guess, and then it can massage the amplitude and the period and the waveform of the oscillation and continually satisfy the periodic boundary value problem and thereby follow the periodic solutions away from the Hopf bifurcation point, even to quite large amplitudes. Okay? So when you use the software, it'll first do a one-parameter bifurcation sweep and say it'll locate a Hopf bifurcation, and it'll leave a little mark on the bifurcation diagram that a Hopf bifurcation occurs there. And then you can come back and grab the Hopf bifurcation point and ask the software to follow the periodic solutions, and it'll do exactly what I described, and you'll see the periodic solutions bifurcating away from the steady states, and it'll plot the amplitude of the periodic solution, the maximum minimum excursion, and it'll also track for you the period of the periodic solution, and you can get it to write that down or plot that for you if you like. Kathy?
If this limit cycle is unstable limit cycle, how can it follow?
yeah, it doesn't matter that the limit cycle is unstable because it's satisfying this periodic boundary value problem. And, okay, yeah, that's a good question, because there are two ways to solve a periodic boundary value problem. One way is called shooting, and the other way is called collocation. And in the shooting method, you start, you're given an initial condition where you start, and you integrate forward in time until you get close to where you started. Hopefully, you can get close to where you started. But you're a little bit off, so then you twiddle things a little bit until you can try to get the solution to close on itself. That's called shooting. And that works nicely. It's very fast if the periodic solution is stable. But it doesn't work so well if the periodic solution is unstable. Collocation is a completely different method of solving the differential equations and is independent of whether the solution is stable or unstable. And Otto uses a collocation method. And it's a little bit hard to describe, so I'm not even going to try off the top of my head, okay? Where am I? Let's go to slide number 22 and talk about the stability of periodic solutions. Okay, so Otto can follow the periodic solutions, and initially it knows whether the periodic solutions are stable or unstable because it knows to which side of the Hopf bifurcation point the periodic solutions have bifurcated. So it knows whether they're stable or unstable. But then the software would like to track the stability of the periodic solutions, because periodic solutions can change their stability, just like steady states can change their stability. So we need to ask, what do we mean by the stability of a periodic solution, and how does the software keep track of the stability of a periodic solution? Okay, so on slide 22, in the middle, to determine the stability of a numerically computed limit cycle, the software, like Otto, must follow the first derivatives of the vector field in the neighborhood of the limit cycle and integrate this over one full period of the oscillation. So I try to illustrate the idea in this little diagram at the bottom of slide 22. So the closed curve is the periodic solution. It closes on itself. It lives in n dimensions. We have an n-dimensional state space, and we have some closed curve that represents the periodic solution. And we want to ask, what happens to small perturbations away from the periodic solution? So I intersect the periodic solution with a plane that's transversal to the periodic solution. In three dimensions, that would be a two-dimensional plane. In an n-dimensional state space, this would be an n-1 dimensional plane that's transversal to the periodic solution. And we want to imagine deviations from the limit cycle in this transverse plane. And we're expecting that those deviations should, in some respect, return to the limit cycle as you proceed around the limit cycle. So in a sense, we want to know what is the direction of the vector field in this plane that's cutting across the limit cycle. And we can't just talk about that at one particular point. We have to kind of move that, sweep that plane around the limit cycle through one period and see what happened to the perturbations. Because they may move away from the limit cycle at first and then come back later. So we have to see the integrated effect around the limit cycle and somehow characterize the fate of these small perturbations. And the way we do that is with something called the Poincaré map. So the idea of a Poincaré map is we make this transverse section at some point on the limit cycle, and we imagine that we start somewhere off the limit cycle on this Poincaré section, and then integrate the differential equations forward in time until the trajectory returns to the Poincaré section. Okay, so we start at some point on this transverse plane. We integrate forward in time. We're not on the limit cycle, but hopefully we stay close to the limit cycle. And after one period or close to one period will return to this Poincaré section and we'll cross the Poincaré section again. We'll cross it at some different point because we didn't start on the periodic solution. If we start on the periodic solution, we'll come exactly back to where we started. But if we start off the periodic solution, when we come back and intersect the Poincaré plane again, we'll be at some different point. Hopefully we'll be a little closer to the limit cycle than we were before. The limit cycle is stable. So we have to characterize the effect of this mapping of the Poincaré section onto itself for repeated iterates of passing around in the neighborhood of the limit cycle. And that characterization is done in terms of numbers called the Floquet multipliers on slide 23. So the Floquet multipliers describe what happens to these little vectors in the Poincaré section under the iterations of this mapping. And there are different ways to define the Floquet multipliers, but the basic idea is that for the mapping in the direction of the limit cycle, it's neutral if you're sitting right on the limit cycle. So the way I've defined them here, one of the Floquet multipliers is exactly equal to one. That's the direction when you pass right around the limit cycle. But if you're off the limit cycle in the n minus one other directions, these Floquet multipliers are different from unity, and they tell you whether you're moving back towards the limit cycle or moving away from the limit cycle. So we have this vector x, which is a function of time, and we integrate it forward through one period, and we ask whether that little vector is measuring how far away from the limit cycle we are, and we want to know if that little vector is getting bigger because we're moving away from the limit cycle, in which case it's unstable, or whether that vector is getting smaller and we're moving back towards the limit cycle. And whether that vector is increasing or decreasing is determined by these Floquet multipliers. And the condition for the limit cycle to be stable is that n minus 1 of these Floquet multipliers that are different from unity, they all have to lie within the unit circle in the complex plane. So in the little diagram, I sketch the complex plane where I'm going to plot the Floquet multipliers, the real part and the imaginary part. I draw a circle around the origin of radius 1, and one of the Floquet multipliers lies exactly at 1, and the other n minus 1 Floquet multipliers have to lie within the unit circle, and then the limit cycle is stable. And if any of the Floquet multipliers escapes from the unit circle, then the limit cycle is unstable, and perturbations from the limit cycle will grow as you iterate this map, and they'll move away from the limit cycle. Tong Lin?
N minus 1 because you disturb the limit cycle from different n minus
1, right? Right. So it's the limit cycle lives in n dimensions, right? And we know that if we disturb the limit cycle in one of those directions, we won't move away and we won't move back. That's the direction along the limit cycle. That would be called a phase shift. If the perturbation is just tangent to the limit cycle, will cause a phase shift in the limit cycle. And so it's neutrally stable with respect, a limit cycle is neutrally stable with respect to phase shifts. So what we're really concerned about are perturbations that are transverse to the limit cycle, perpendicular to the limit cycle, and we want to know whether those are coming back. And it's those that are characterized by the other n minus 1 Floquet multipliers. Okay, and we want to make sure that they all lie within the unit circle. Kathy, did you have a question?
I understand the real part has to be less than 1 because the amplitude, you want the amplitude to decrease, right? But what about the imaginary part?
The float, remember the way it's defined, x at time T plus capital T is mu times x at time t. And we want to know whether the magnitude of the vector x is increasing. And I think if you write down what happens to the magnitude of the vector x, it's determined by the magnitude of the flow k multiplier, which is the square root of the sum of the squares of the real and imaginary parts. So you have to take into account both of them. Okay. Now, the best way to understand this is to understand what happens to the limit cycle when flow k multipliers escape from the unit circle. Then the limit cycle undergoes some kind of a bifurcation. If the n minus 1 flow k multipliers are inside the unit circle, it's a nice, stable, well-behaved limit cycle. Now, how do they misbehave? What are the bifurcations that can occur at a limit cycle? Those bifurcations occur when flow k multipliers escape from the unit circle. So on slide 24, I describe essentially the three different ways that flow k multipliers can escape from the unit circle. In one case, a real flow k multiplier escapes from the unit circle by passing through minus 1. And that's called a period doubling bifurcation of the limit cycle. So why is it called a period doubling bifurcation? So remember, this little vector x represents a small perturbation away from the limit cycle. And after I go round the cycle once and return to the Poincaré section, x gets multiplied by lambda. Now, if lambda is a little bit more negative than minus 1, what happens to this little perturbation, x? So suppose I perturb away from the limit cycle, kind of in a northerly direction. And I integrate once around, and when I come back to the Poincaré section, that little vector has now gotten multiplied by minus 2, say. And now it's pointing in a southerly direction, and it's further away from the limit cycle. And when I go around the second time, I'm now pointing in a northerly direction again, but now I'm 4 times away from the limit cycle. Okay? So I'm moving away from the limit cycle, but each time I go around, I find myself on one side or on the other side. So the limit cycle is losing stability by this kind of alternation route. And we expect that close to the bifurcation point, eventually there'll be a stable cycle that will catch the flow, and that stable cycle is then a periodic solution which starts at a certain place, comes around once, and doesn't close on itself because now it was north and now it's south, and then when it goes around the second time, it's back on the northern side and it can close on itself. So the system has to go around 2 times capital T, before it can close on itself. So that's a typical period doubling bifurcation of limit cycles. Quite common. And but period threes come from a different root, okay? So you can get a period doubling. Well, let's talk about some other ways that we can bifurcate. We can also bifurcate because a pair of complex conjugate flow k multipliers escapes from the unit circle. And I've drawn an example in the second row here. So a pair of complex conjugate flow k multipliers escapes from the unit circle. Now, So now I imagine a perturbation away from the limit cycle. So suppose the perturbation is in the northerly direction. And as we go around one time and come back to the Poincaré section, I have to multiply by this complex conjugate multipliers. And when I multiply by a complex conjugate, the length of the vector increases or decreases depending upon the magnitude of the multiplier, right? And the magnitude of the multiplier is bigger than 1. So the little vector is getting longer. But also the little vector getting rotated by an angle theta, which is determined by the imaginary part of the flow k multiplier. So it causes a little rotation. If, If you go through minus 1, the rotation is 180 degrees. Okay, so it was north, and it's south, and then it's north again. So that's the real Fouquet multiplier going through minus 1. But in this case, I make it rotated by 120 degrees. So now I'm pointing in some other direction. And then the second time around, I get rotated by another angle. And the third time around, rotated again. If it were precisely 120 degrees, you might guess that you could have a period 3. You'd have to go around 3 times before you could close on yourself. But actually, I think that's maybe unlikely as well. What you tend to get in this case is, this is called a torus bifurcation, because the limit cycle becomes unstable and it blows up, it kind of inflates like a balloon into a torus. And now the trajectories go round, and they don't quite come back on themselves. They come to a different place on the circle. Remember, the Poincaré section is going to cut a torus in a circle. And now, every time you come back to the Poincaré section, you're at some other place on the on that circle. And if the angle of rotation is not a rational number, you'll never close on yourself. And that's the most likely situation, that it never closes on itself. It keeps going round on this torus and never closes on itself, but also never does anything really too strange either. So that's called a torus bifurcation. Okay? And it gives you solutions that are almost periodic. They're not exactly periodic, but they're almost periodic. Now, what happened to my computer? It turned itself off because I forgot to plug it in. Okay. The last example I have to turn it on. Okay. The last example is that the Fouquet multiplier passes through plus 1. So, and this is a second Fouquet multiplier passing through plus 1, because there's always one exactly at plus 1, but another Fouquet multiplier passes through plus 1. Smaller than 1 and then becomes larger than 1. And now, the perturbations away from the limit cycle just get kind of larger and larger. And this is called sometimes called a cyclic fold bifurcation, or a saddle node of periodic orbits. So it looks something like a saddle node of steady states. At a saddle node of steady states, an eigenvalue of the Jacobian matrix goes from minus through zero to plus, and a saddle and a node come together and annihilate each other. In this case, for periodic solutions, a Fouquet multiplier goes from less than plus 1 to bigger than plus 1, and that happens when a stable limit cycle and an unstable limit cycle come together and annihilate each other, and past the bifurcation point, there is no limit cycle, and the trajectories just carry you away from the region where the limit cycles used to live and take you to some other attractor of the differential equation. So that's called a saddle node of periodic orbits, or a cyclic fold bifurcation. And that happens quite frequently in these dynamical systems. At a cyclic of the annihilation. Well, I mean, do you think the way I think about it is an analogy to the steady state situation. So you're looking, at a saddle node of steady states. You look in the vicinity of this steady state, and you find that one of the eigenvalues, a real eigenvalue, is getting closer and closer to zero. Okay, so something funny is happening. And when it When it's identically equal to zero, remember what the picture looks like. A saddle and a node have come together, and in one characteristic direction, trajectories are approaching the saddle node from one side, and they're going away from the saddle node on the other side. That's what's happening when the eigenvalues are identically equal to zero. So something similar is happening at a saddle node of periodic solutions. So remember, at a stable, for a stable limit cycle, if you perturb, say, the characteristic direction, say, the north-south direction. So if I disturb north and I come around, I come closer to the limit cycle. And if I perturb in the southerly direction, I come north and come back to the limit cycle, because it's an attracting limit cycle. If it's an unstable limit cycle, then I move away. I move away, keep moving away in the northerly direction, keep moving away in the southerly direction. Well, when two limit cycles can come together and coalesce and annihilate each other, and when they come together, now you may be still attracting from the southerly direction, but now you're repelling in the northerly direction. That's the analogy that I'm trying to make here. And when you go past the bifurcation point, there is no limit cycle anymore. They're gone because they've annihilated each other, and the vector field just carries you through, and you have to go to some other place in state space, to some other attractor. Okay. So at some of these, at a period doubling bifurcation, you don't lose a limit cycle. There's a stable periodic solution past the period doubling bifurcation. You just have to go around twice before you close on yourself. Or at a torus bifurcation, as the steady state, as the limit cycle loses stability, there's a toroidal surface that gains stability. And the almost periodic solutions live on the torus, and the torus is now stable. But at the cyclic fold bifurcation, when you go past the bifurcation, the limit cycles are gone. They've annihilated each other. Yeah, Tung Li?
Back to your first talk about your satisfaction. So you're
yes.
Saying that you may need multiple complement maps to characterize the limit cycles, and some of them may go away.
So, right. At a steady, in an n-dimensional state space, okay, and you have an n-dimensional state space. You have n variables that describe the dynamics of your system. If you're analyzing a steady state, then you have to ask what happens to perturbations in any direction around the steady state. You can go in any direction, and the fate of those perturbations is determined by the real part of the eigenvalues of the Jacobian matrix. And it's an n-dimensional state space, and there are n eigenvalues of the Jacobian matrix. And all of those eigenvalues have to have negative real part. So for a steady state in the complex plane, all the eigenvalues have to lie in the left half of the complex plane, to the left of the imaginary axis. And if any eigenvalue or pair of complex conjugate eigenvalues crosses the imaginary axis, the steady state loses stability. Okay? And then we look at the two classical bifurcations that we look at are the saddle node, where a real one crosses, and all the n-1 other eigenvalues stay in the left half plane. And at a hub bifurcation, a pair of complex conjugate eigenvalues crosses the axis, and all the other n-2 stay on the left half of the complex plane. Okay? Now, it's a similar thing when we're looking at the stability of a limit cycle. It's an n-dimensional state space, and the limit cycle is a closed curve in that n-dimensional state space. And a limit cycle is neutrally stable with respect to perturbations along the limit cycle. Okay, because those just correspond to phase shifts of the limit cycle. And they're not corrected. Okay? So if we want to talk about the stability of a limit cycle, we talk about the stability perpendicular to the limit cycle. And that's going to be described by n-1 numbers. And those n-1 numbers are the flow K multipliers. And because now we're talking about a Poincaré map, a mapping instead of a of a differential thing, like the stability of a steady state, the flow k multipliers have to lie within the unit circle. So there's a bigger constraint, in a sense, on these flow k multipliers. And all n minus 1 flow k multipliers have to lie within the unit circle for the limit cycle to be stable. And if any one of them, or pair of them, escapes from the unit circle, the limit cycle becomes unstable and it has undergone a bifurcation. And so what I was trying to describe here on slide 24 is just the types of bifurcations that can happen to limit cycles. Yes. It's the same result, no matter where you put your Poincaré section, right? I mean, all these things would have to be proved. I don't know how to prove them. That would be in the textbook somewhere. So why we associate cyclic folds with a real flow k multiplier going through plus 1, and I'm afraid I can't explain it any better than I did. So I would have to refer you to the classical textbooks on bifurcation theory. Okay, any other questions that I can't answer?